Theo, thank you for coming in. I mean, you're a physicist by training. You're doing amazing work. You've got a marvelous background. You're making great discoveries and great groundwork in the whole area of quantum information technology and science. And you're at the edge there, doing some amazing work. So thank you for coming in today.
Thanks, Stefan, for having me.
So Theo, one of the questions I always ask is, you've got this amazing career, right? You're published. You got this amazing educational background. You're definitely in the leading edge in new quantum technologies, fault tolerant quantum computing, and so on. And so, what were the inflection points early in your life that made this wonderful career have? And it could have been something when you were 3 or 5, 10, something in school, outside of school, family member. It could have been some external event, or maybe you're really interested in experimenting in science when you were young. What are those things that created you?
That's a good question. So I guess I sort of blossomed in high school. I was kind of a nerd, obviously, but in terms of the kind of science I lacked at the time was twofold. I really loved physics, but I also very much enjoyed low-level electronics. But I quickly came to realize that I was coming maybe 40 or 50 years too late to make any meaningful contribution to low-level electronics. Too many smart people came before me. So I focused on physics, trained as a physicist at École Polytechnique here in France. And actually, I joined École Polytechnique back in 2012, just when Serge Haroche and David Wainwright got the Nobel Prize for manipulating individual quantum system. And I think that was a perfect timing for me because I was good at math, obviously, but not string theory good at math, if you know what I mean. So, but I still wanted to work on fundamental physics. And this specific intersection of elementary quantum physics with experiments was really a great opportunity for me because it's a unique time where we get to play with things that used to be thought experiments. Like I have a box, I put photons on it, I look at how measurement and information introduces decoherence, those kind of things. But you can do it in the real life and start building machine and even then computers out of them. And this allowed me to bring back the second passion of low-level electronics when we aim at building a quantum computer and just restarting all over again, but with a new set of rules. So yeah, that's how I fell into quantum computing.
So you had this really interesting sort of interest in science and math and physics and things like that, electronics, but you figured that there's just too many other things happening there, and so you had to make your way into physics, and then you got interested in quantum physics as well. And so you ended up you got your master's degree, and then you got your PhD in quantum physics in Lyon. And there's this thing called Alice and Bob. So why did you call it Alice and Bob?
So yeah, with my friend and now partner in crime, Raphael Lescan, we started Alice and Bob right after our PhD, actually right before defending our PhD thesis. The reason why we named the company Alice and Bob is sort of a private joke. Alice and Bob are the two characters, placeholders in textbook exercise to name the point A and point B of a thought experiment. It's mostly used in cryptography, but at the time we didn't know. We only encountered those two characters through quantum protocols, quantum thought experiments, textbooks. And the reason why we named the company this way is so it's kind of we wanted to avoid the word quantum at all costs. Because the word quantum is so polluted by pop culture to mean magical. There is nothing magical in quantum mechanics. It's very counterintuitive, but it's our best depiction of the way nature behaves. And building a quantum computer is just like a textbook exercise. It's pretty challenging, and it requires an elegant solution, which is exactly what we're doing here.
So you, as I mentioned, you got this master's degree. You did your PhD in quantum physics, but you worked alongside your colleague here on bit flip protected qubit design. Can you talk about what that means to the audience? And it was published by Nature Physics, right? So.
Yeah, well, there is a bit of background required here to understand what we're talking about. So the general field is quantum computing, and it's a known fact for physicists for decades now that the main challenge in building a quantum computer is making a machine that escapes decoherence. Because in itself, building a quantum computer is sort of a paradox. On one hand, you want a machine that behaves quantum mechanically, so it has to be perfectly isolated from the rest of the world. And on the other hand, you want it to be a computer, a machine you can program, input data, output results. And combining the two is tremendously difficult. And so to combine the two, you need something that is called quantum error correction. You need a way to fight against decoherence or against the natural tendency of quantum system to fall into classical states. And so the historical approach by the community to quantum error correction has always been through a tremendous redundancy. I mean, error correction is always about redundancy, but when it comes to quantum computing, the figures, the numbers involved are just tremendous. We're talking about a thousandfold overhead, meaning if you want to protect one bit of quantum information, you would need 1,000 quantum bits, physical quantum bits, on your device. So that was kind of the background in which we started and evolved. The effort to which we contributed, and actually it was mostly Raphael, was a novel approach, saying there must be an easier way. And so drawing inspiration from the science of automation of classical mechanical system, he and his colleagues design a novel quantum bit with a hardwired feedback loop embedded into it in its design, so that it would be stable by design. Just like you can engineer a mechanical system or an electric system circuits to be bistable, we designed a quantum bit, the so-called cat qubit, because it uses a Schrödinger cat state that is able to suppress half of its errors, meaning one of the two types of errors that can occur in a quantum bit, namely the bit flips here.
So that's your design to help with this protecting against decoherence, or having this, as you indicated, 1,000-to-1 sort of ratio of, if you have all this redundancy to for this bit, quantum bit, you have 1,000 others to provide some kind of error correction kind of capability, right? And this, so with this bit flip protected qubit design, how does it reduce the requirements for this error correction? Can you sort of like put a number to it? By what factor does it help you to escape decoherence?
Yeah, so it's the thing I just mentioned that is important is that in quantum mechanics, you do not have one, but two types of errors to fight against. You have bit flips, just like in classical computing, switching a zero into a one and vice versa. But you also have a purely quantum error called phase shifts that switch the phase of a superposed state 0 plus 1 to 0 minus 1. Long story short, two types of errors to correct for. So the figure I mentioned earlier, so 1,000-to-1 ratio, actually boils down to 30 times 30, I mean, two dimension, a square grid of physical qubits, 30 qubit wide, each dimension correcting for one type of errors. At least this is the promise or the roadmap of most of the player in the industry. Now, thanks to the inherent bit flip protection of the cat qubit, we directly suppress one of the two dimensions of this error correction code. So we're left with only 30 qubits or just a chain, a 1D repetition code to protect against the remaining phase trip through redundancy. But actually, we went a bit further. So first, we did a careful resource analysis against a very tough use case, the Shor algorithm RSA 2048. And what we proved in this paper last year is that when you include all the routing, all the type of overhead that is involved, at the end of the day, our approach saves a 60-fold in terms of qubit count. So that was already very promising, but then we were not satisfied. So we went for a better error correction code because we used to target this repetition code I mentioned, which is kind of the most naive error correcting code you can think of. It's just a majority vote in some sense. And so now our novel architecture using low density parity check codes or LDPC codes is proven to be 200 times more efficient or requires 200 times fewer quantum bits. So this is kind of the scale of the saving we're talking about. It's a machine that is not only 200 times simpler, but also 200 times cheaper to build, and that's way more realistic.
So that's really interesting. And because you're publishing on your work, are you making this work available, or are you keeping some of this sort of to yourselves and because you're a company too, right? Or not?
Oh, we're just a company. But we're indeed a company that publishes a lot, huh? And that is actually pretty core to our strategy here in this race to quantum computing. The way I view it is that quantum computing is sort of an endurance race, and the key element are talents. And so AlexandBob was founded by physicists coming from academia, myself included, and we were, convinced from the get-go that our proximity with academia and with this brain pool, in some sense, was one of our core strengths. So we built a strategy that is to play along with academia, to keep publishing, keep going to conferences. For example, at this year's APS March meeting, we have more than 10 talks disclosing all our advances in terms of design, methods, algorithm. But indeed, as a company, we need to protect what we do, and so we patent. But at the end of the day, our main protection is just to innovate faster than our competitors and keep doing so years after years, and this is how we'll win this race.
Ah, so that's interesting. So are you going to be at IEEE Quantum Week, or have you gone to that conference?
We've been actually we've given tutorials where we play along, we're presenting many conferences. I think every other week Alice and Bob is at the conference. And the rest of the team works out to produce novel content for the next conferences, I guess.
I see. So you're on the road hitting all the major conferences on quantum computing. Do you spend a lot of time then talking to your colleagues at these conferences as well, right? That's kind of sharing knowledge and, it's a community, and you really are trying to solve together these problems, even though you're in competition, but you're also trying to share as well, right?
To be pretty blunt, to my core, I think no one has the right answer to quantum computing. And anyone thinking otherwise, I think is tremendously foolish. It's a very tough challenge to build a full-fledged quantum computer, and it involves some very different fields from material science to error correcting codes to algorithm to some funny electromagnetics and obviously quantum mechanics everywhere, quantum optics. So we need the best of each and every science to build this machine. And so if we were living in a bunker, I don't think we would be challenged intellectually enough to come up with the right ideas and to so it's a game where you need to give to provide some insights to the community in exchange for their challenges, their tough questions that can help us put our efforts where the real innovations are required.
There's over 200 projects around the world. There's a couple of hundred startups as well, and you're competing. I mean, I know. I mean, I'm from Canada, and the Canadian government has something called the Deep Tech Fund. It's a Canadian government. I would call it a sovereign fund, and they invest in responsible AI. They invest in photonics, and they invested in Xanadu. And Xanadu, a couple of years ago, went unicorn in terms of valuation and investment. So, in terms of your kind of what you're trying to do, then can you you know, like what particular realm of quantum computing are you doing? So you've got this new method of escaping decoherence, you know, of doing this design so that it's more fault tolerant. Are you building the entire quantum system and including the other algorithms that could be used with it? Or are you partnering with those who are kind of working on quantum inspired algorithms or quantum algorithms? Are you building all of the hardware as well? And then what is the nature of the approach you're taking in your quantum computing?
So indeed, we're a hardware company at LS&Bomb. What we do is that we build a universal fault-tolerant quantum computer. So the ideal general-purpose kind of computer. So digital error-corrected quantum computer. We do so out of a novel design of superconducting circuits, but except for the design, all the other aspects of the machine are completely analogous to what you'll find in some of our competitors' machines, like Google or IBM or others playing with superconducting circuits. Meaning, we design chips that we manufacture ourselves, and that we cool down in fridge and dilution refrigerators very close to 10 millikelvin, and that is controlled by very fast electronics, FPGA boards typically. And so our mission at LS&Bomb is really to provide access to distribute the computing power of those machines. And here we have a free way to engage with customers. So we do a bit of consulting, we provide cloud access, and we also do on-premise machines for special types of clients. In our consulting team, what we do is that we help corporates shape up their quantum strategy, put figures on their use cases. And for us, it's extremely valuable because it provides a feedback loops that feeds into our hardware design. There are choices we're bound to make that will be more or less optimal for certain family of use cases, even though the machine will still be able to run all of them. You know, just like x86 instruction set of CPUs. There are choices that have been made that are more or less optimal for certain types of algorithm, even though the machine is still universal. So this is one way to engage. Then we're distributing access to our first machines. We announced Equinix a few months back. We'll soon announce one of the three hyperscalers as our first open cloud distribution. And the last one is on-premise. Here, we're mostly answering public procurement calls or HPC centers that want to equip their computing capabilities with the next generation of quantum computers.
So, in you know, there's different measurements of the capabilities of quantum computing, and you know, IBM has their own sort of way of quantifying, you know, the capabilities of their quantum computing. But you'll find different people have different measures. How do you quantify where you are? So you know, you do have this undercurrent of escaping decoherence and bringing the first fault-tolerant quantum computing. A universal gate quantum computing system. And then do you put out measures of your capability, just like IBM or others, they regularly put out these measures of, hey, we now have, you know, a thousand logical qubits or whatever, right? So.
Most of the metrics used in the community are actually have been designed for the NISQ era. NISQ stands for Noisy Intermediate Scale. And so the NISQ era was the era of the early days of quantum computing, where you have those noisy machines and kind of fall short of the promises of quantum computing. We're coming from the next wave, the fault-tolerant quantum computing, the proper quantum, I mean, where we know the promises of quantum computing are backed by algorithmic proofs. And so here, the key milestone of the whole field is still open. It's the first proper logical qubit, meaning the first man-made system to escape decoherence. And this milestone really echoes Sputnik, because just like Sputnik escaped gravity for 3 months and was a completely useless machine just beeping out there, well, Sputnik signaled the beginning of the space era. I think the first proper logical qubit will signal the beginning of the quantum era in some sense. So in terms of the metrics we put forth at Alice and Bob, we're putting two kinds of metrics forth. So one is on the experimental side, how well are we doing down on that road? And here, for example, we've demonstrated a bit flip correction over 7 orders of magnitude, 10 million fold improvement of the bit flip time, the time between two bit flips. And we're working on the phase flip through this repetition code I mentioned. And the other metric we're pushing, quantifying the quality of our architecture. And so, for example, the latest architecture we published aims at creating 100 logical qubits with error rate as low as 10 to the minus 8, so proper logical qubits, with just 1500 cat qubits, so 1500 logical qubits, physical qubits, sorry, which is a machine that is in the ballpark of what other players can do today in the industry. So we know the road we're on is completely realistic and can deliver impact, because machine with 100 logical qubits would already start delivering impactful use cases in deep physics, like spin chains and fundamental science that are not just quantum computing. So this is extremely exciting.
So, when do you feel that the work that you're doing will reach a commercialization sort of threshold where, you know, people will say you've done it and you now got a universal gate quantum computer, and we can use it for all sorts of problems and that are very aligned with you know what quantum computing is capable of doing. Are you able to kind of project into the future where that would happen?
What we're targeting internally, I mean, it's still fundamental science, so a grain of salt is required, is to deliver by the end of 2026 the first MVP of a complete fault-tolerant machine. So a machine that will demonstrate all the individual building blocks of an ideal quantum computer? How do you do long-lived logical qubits? How do you do routing between them? How do you do gates without introducing errors? Things like that. And how do you compile that? But the machine would still be too small to be impactful. Yeah. Now, the 100 logical qubit machine that will have a deep impact is targeting, we are targeting 2028 internally to deliver such a machine. So within 4 to 5 years.
I see. So that's it's interesting. 2026, where you're really proving that you understand creating a universal quantum computing system, which is fault tolerant, right? And then it's just an engineering issue, right? So just scaling that engineering. And then 2 years from 2026 to 2028, you'll get the engineering down where, hey, here's a useful computer now. We understand fault tolerance. We proved it with all the different kind of components within 2026 and by 2028. Here's a working one that you can use to solve practical and apply against practical problems that are out there. And it'd be better than classical systems. And then
Exactly. And from there, it just it's more of the same. As you scale the size of the machine, you open up more and more use cases. From starting with chemistry, material science, then you can move on to some optimization problem, life science, and finally all linear. I mean, plenty of use case of linear algebra, Monte Carlo method, Shor algorithm. And as we move forward, we'll unlock more and more of those use cases. Something we'll be publishing by the end of spring or early summer is our modular architecture. So, how once you figure it out how to do quantum error correction, how it becomes very easy to scale in a very modular fashion, either within a fridge or interconnecting fridges to create a large scale quantum computer.
I see. And then from a partnership standpoint, then you know, like Microsoft has this thing called the Microsoft Quantum Elements, and there's other companies that are out that are really providing access to a lot of different kinds of gear that's out there. You have Oak Ridge National Laboratories. Some of the American laboratories are kind of experimenting across many different sort of systems that are out there and then providing them. Are you doing that as well then? You got partnerships out there where companies are going to provide you, and then they can start working with you in this way, or and can you name some of these partners and things like that?
Yeah, indeed. So even though the machine are not yet impactful, we're a startup. We're fueled by venture capital, and so we need to demonstrate the progress and how powerful our qubits are. So we need sort of showrooms for the performances and to create this excitation in the community for those machines that are coming fast. So indeed, through the cloud access, where we're already distributing our machine via Equinix, we'll soon do it in one of the three hyperscalers. Can't disclose it yet, but in a month or so, it should be out. And then we'll keep expanding those showrooms to provide access to more and more types of companies, of users. But another axis where we're also leveraging is our partnerships with academia. And here it's really about open science. It's saying, well, at Alice and Bob, we have a strong capacity to push the edge of science, but we need the full support of academia. And for that, we need to provide them with challenges, with machines, with hardware, so that they can work on tough topics and contribute to the general field of science.
So, you know, you talked about Shor's algorithm and things like that, and its application you know, there's this idea of RSA, and the RSA is going to be broken and so on. And you know, NIST has a number of years ago, 2015, put out a almost like a tender, saying that, you know, can you put out ways to be quantum safe, right? And those specs have already been published, and you know, there people can use them and so on. So when you have a sort of the dream of a universal quantum computing where basically it can work on any problem, there's no limitations. Do you see, and it's an engineering problem, you know, as you continue to scale, do you see that scaling reach a point in 2032 where basically you can apply it to anything, or further out? Is it before 2032 or after 2032, 2035? I mean, you've indicated that you got these milestones of 2026, 2028, then you're going to continue just scaling from there, but scaling to the point where you can say, you know, it's optimization, it's drug discovery, it's new novel material science, it's whatever I apply it to, I can use it. When is that, do you think?
So not all use cases come with the same challenges. I mean, it really depends on the type of speed up and the size of the problem you want to break. So indeed, chemistry and those will come before the end of the decade. We'll start deliver. I mean, serving industries and changing the way many fields operate before the end of this decade for sure. Now. If you look at, for example, Shor algorithm to break RSA 2048, well, it's a tough one because it requires some very good logical qubits and quite a few of them. So we're safe for quite some time. I'd say at least until 2032, 2034, at least, because of the scale of the machine, it requires more than 6,000 proper logical qubits and really very logical qubits. So it's one of the most challenging. But then afterwards you have use cases that don't promise exponential or super polynomial speedup, like Grover algorithm to search in a database where on quantum Monte Carlo, where is a, it's a, I mean it's a Monte Carlo method to explore statistics. And for those, you only have the promise of a quadratic speedup. So to beat a classical system with just a quadratic speedup, well, the problem needs to be pretty big because classical systems or classical machines are just already so fast and so big. It will unlock one after another all those use cases gradually. But what I find the most exciting is that we're just barely scratching the surface of the space of quantum algorithm. When you think about it, there has just been very few people out there designing and inventing quantum algorithm so far because it was a purely academic sort of a thought experiment thing. Now that it start to become a reality with machine with a real world impact, it's fair to anticipate that the number of people working on designing novel algorithm will completely explode. And thus, we might find some very exciting, very novel types of algorithm. Just very much like if you think about it in the 40s, if you were to ask someone, what will classical computers be used for? Well, maybe computing ballistics, cracking some codes. But they could not envision the scale and how central classical computers will become or have become in our modern societies.
How about the intermarriage then between, you know, there's exascale supercomputing, zettascale would be the next milestone. There's using sort of shorter math to do much bigger exascale on the AI side, so we'll probably hit over 100 AI exaflops if you're not focusing on, you know, these massive kind of floating point operations, but you can scale that back and some AI operations. So you get much bigger exascale capability in AI. There's analog computing and analog systems on a chip, and what that means, and how it can maybe precisely represent certain kinds of problems and provide solutions. So really, this integration of hybrid of exascale, zettascale, AI exaflops, AI itself, all the advanced techniques in AI, advances in quantum-inspired algorithms, and then combining that with quantum computing as it scales up, or as your fault-tolerant quantum computing scales up. The integration of all of that, what are your views on that? So the systems are really hybrid now, right? So.
Yep. So the first thing that is very important to say that quantum computers are not one size fit all. Actually, they're just meant for a handful of core algorithms. But if you want to do let's say just a multiplication, where using a quantum computer is extremely inefficient. I usually say just like trying to get better with a lightsaber. It's not just overkill, it's extremely inefficient. So quantum computers are bound to be connected to other types of computing system. Just like GPUs are still connected to CPUs, and they thrive in those in this ecosystem of capabilities. But regarding the HPC or the supercalculators, I think it's an error it's wrong to think quantum will just be part of the subclass of supercomputers, because supercomputers, at the end of the day, they're just slightly more of the same than just your laptop or your so they're useful for some specific task, and nowadays we're saying it like for training large AI model, for example. But they don't really create this breakthrough in terms of changing the realm of possibilities, because they're maybe like a thousand or 100,000 times bigger than your laptop. But when we talk about quantum computers, each time you add a quantum bit, you double its equivalent computing power. So plus 10 equals times 1,000, plus 20 equals times 1,000,000. So it's very rapidly a complete shift of paradigm in terms of what is possible. And in my view, the adoption of quantum computing will be much broader than just the HPC market, because it's just changing the way the realm of possibilities for a very wide range of use cases. That being said, it will still always be coupled to classical machines, because we spend so much time optimizing classical system that it would be a shame to throw that away.
Well, that's an exciting time. You're a leader in this area, and of course you have a startup, so you're hoping to have you hope to follow the path of Jensen Huang of NVIDIA, right?
Exactly. I mean, when you think about it, you mentioned earlier that there are maybe 100 or more quantum computing startup. I believe in the 90s there was nearly 100 startup trying to build on GPUs and to develop for just two to make it. So I think history might repeat itself here. And yeah, but we still have quite a bit of work and a lot of things to invent to make this a reality and provide all those promises to our societies.
So this is the last question then. And so what other additional observations, comments, recommendations you want to make to the audience in your closing statement?
Maybe one message is, when you think about quantum computing, especially if you're a business that might be impacted by quantum computing, the message I often say that think about the cost of being too early versus the cost of being too late. And this really changed some mindset, because, yeah, well, you're small quantum algorithm team. If you're, let's say, a car manufacturer working on novel battery design, for example, your small quantum computing team might cost you a few million a year to run. But if you miss the early days of quantum computing, well, players will start securing IP patents on novel design, novel types of batteries. This might put you completely out of business. So I think today is really the right time to get into quantum because it's coming and it's coming very fast.
Yeah, and it's definitely available through different services and so on. So yeah, I believe that I agree. People should have to start dipping their toes in and trying it, right? So Theo, thank you for coming in and sharing your insights with the audience, and congratulations on all of your fine work in your your work on decoherence and trying to make things much more stable and fault tolerant. You're a leader in this area. So thank you for coming in and sharing insights.
Thanks a lot, Stefan, for your time and having me today.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.